You're listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. Living on Gumbunya country in Australia, this is your host, Lucy Van Sandy. And welcome back to Talk the Walk. Like many social workers, my guest today came to the profession after more than 20 years in teaching. Arriving in Darwin in 1993, Barry Sullivan started out in school counselling before joining Relationships Australia, where he has been ever since. Barry recently completed his Master's in Narrative Therapy and Community Work with a focus on justice doing and its relationship to clinical supervision. Barry has supported a number of counselling staff in individual and group supervision, including those working in remote Aboriginal communities in the Top End. It is this part of Barry's practice that I'm really looking forward to exploring today. So welcome to the podcast, Barry.
Thank you, Lucy.
I wonder if you might begin by telling us a bit about your experience of supervision with practitioners working in remote Aboriginal communities.
The opportunity came about just because of how things were assigned at work at Relationships Australia. It wasn't necessarily something I directly chose. So I had the opportunity to, as you mentioned, work with a couple of people, supervise a couple who were working on Aboriginal communities. So one of the things that I tried to bring to that experience, because I have limited experience myself in working in Aboriginal communities, was listening carefully to the experience of the supervisor I was speaking to about how they were finding their experience of working on an Aboriginal community, looking not only for the challenges that they might be encountering, but also those things that were, you know, sparkling moments, life-giving sorts of times as well.
And so can you speak a little bit about the sorts of issues that these practitioners raised with you during supervision? What were those challenges for them?
Certainly the main challenges were centering around working and for some supervisors actually living as well in a cross-cultural context, and it being something that was quite a new experience for those supervisees. So the challenge of having to perhaps in some cases let go somewhat of some Western ways of thinking and approaching things, and allowing the workers they were working with, or the children or the families they were working with on the community, being willing to learn something from them about, you know, an Aboriginal worldview, an Aboriginal approach to doing things, which is different from a Western way of thinking about things and doing things.
Can you tell us about some of the ethical dilemmas that perhaps some of the practitioners encountered as they were living or working out in communities? Does anything spring to your mind?
The principal ethical dilemma that I can recall is around what we might call Aboriginal ways of raising children or child-rearing practices, some of which are certainly different from Western ways of doing things. So the ethical dilemma often was, is what the supervisee I'm working with, is what he or she is hearing from Aboriginal children that she's working with, is that something that has a potential to be harmful for the child? Or is it merely something that's different from a Western experience? So somehow trying to walk that fine line in that area.
And so am I right in thinking that this has implications in terms of whether we make reports on things that are concerning or not?
Exactly. That's certainly one of the direct areas in which there would be an ethical dilemma, I suppose, that yes, is this something that needs to be reported because of potential harm to the child? Or is it more, you know, something that can be worked with, something that's more of a learning opportunity for the worker in terms of, well, this is just a different way of doing things rather than a harmful or a wrong way of doing things?
And so how do you support practitioners in working through those kinds of dilemmas?
The sort of ways I would try to practice there is to invite the practitioner, the supervisee, to be speaking about, well, what is it you're noticing here? What might some of your concerns be? Where do you think those concerns might be coming from? Trying to encourage all the time an examination of the cultural world from which, I suppose, in which both myself and the supervisee are normally immersed, that Western way of doing things, that because we're so immersed in that culture, unless there's an invitation to stand back and reflect on that, it can be hard to see, well, this is a way of thinking, this is a way of approaching things. It's not necessarily the way of doing things. There could be other ways. So trying to invite that stepping back and examining, yes, what are some cultural practices here that we're used to? And what are some Aboriginal cultural practices that you might be noticing or learning about, and what might that mean?
And are there other ways that you bring a cultural lens into the supervision room? For example, how might you use consultants in the service, their voice, I guess, in the supervision process?
This is something that I suppose there's been a bit of a, I'm not sure whether dilemma is the right word, but it's the word I'll use, for myself and also for the organisation. My preference would certainly have been for me as a supervisor to be able to spend some time with a cultural consultant and to encourage the supervisee to do the same. And just because of funding realities and so forth, there was an opportunity for the supervisee to spend some time with a cultural consultant, which we could then speak about in our supervision by my asking the supervisee, what's that like? What are you learning from that experience? There wasn't that same opportunity for me as a supervisor to do that, which it's part of an unfortunate reality that all of us have to work within some budget constraints that, yeah, they're a reality, they're not always a helpful reality.
Can you speak a bit more about your narrative therapy research paper, which you sent me a copy of, and perhaps that's something that you might like to share a bit more widely? We can talk about that later. But why did you focus on justice doing in relation to clinical supervision?
I suppose I should speak first of all about my interest in justice and justice doing itself. That's come from a long time back in my lifetime, well before I moved here to the Territory and well before I moved into the social work field, where my past life as a teacher and a member of the Christian Brothers Order as part of the Catholic Church aroused for me much interest in, if I'm going to work as a Christian, which is still an important part of my life, then issues of justice are a vital part. And that was part of the culture I was brought up with as a student at a Christian Brothers school and then as part of the Christian Brothers Order myself. So that interest in justice and in contributing to justice doing has been a part of my life for a long time. And then when it came to the opportunity to think about, well, what do I want to focus on as a project in the Masters of Narrative Therapy, because I was at that time more highly involved in both individual and group supervision than I currently am in my role, and because of that interest in justice, I thought, well, this would be a good opportunity for me to put these two things together, to do some more reading in the area, and then to see, well, how can I put it into practice within my supervision? So that's a bit of a history of where it came from.
Yeah, and so what did you find in your reading? What really stood out to you in terms of justice doing and what other people were doing, I guess, around the country and in other places?
I suppose the most influential readings that I did were a narrative practitioner called Vicky Reynolds, who was born in and works in Canada and has done quite a bit of writing in the area of both justice and supervision. And one of the things I strongly picked up from that reading was that any therapy work, and therefore any supervision work that supports the therapy work, it's important that there's some sense of justice there. That and one of the phrases I remember Vicky using is, therapy is not about helping a client to adjust to some issue of injustice. It's more about how can we assist the client to, in whatever circumstances that they're in, make some stand for justice or make some stand against that injustice that they're seeing that's impacting on them in their lives.
So can you give us a bit of an insight into what you found, what you were writing about when you were exploring this idea of justice doing in supervision? What did you come up with and how did it influence, I guess, your supervision?
What I tried to do was I had, I think, a five individual supervisees in that particular year, and only one of whom was living and working in an Aboriginal community. But I invited all of my supervisees if they wanted to be a part of the project, and not all of them chose to be, of course, which I respected. So I was trying to bring this idea of supervision and justice doing in a number of contexts. So not only the context of working with someone working in an Aboriginal community, but also another practitioner whose work played a big part in what I was doing, who was at that time working in another part of the top end, Catherine, with a number of Aboriginal clients, but not only Aboriginal clients, in an urban context, engaged in one or two of the schools in Catherine. So they were the two main supervisees I was working with. And then also I invited another colleague whom I wasn't doing supervision for, whom I knew was working strongly with clients who were refugees. And that was another strong area of interest for me in terms of justice. So I know I spent some time speaking with her about her experience of working in that area. And I know one of the spin-offs of that, and this was, again, this came from a challenge that David Denborough put forward. Somehow, the justice doing, it can't just be expressed in what I was doing in supervision. Somehow it needs to be expressed in my life as well. So one of the things I chose to do, and Kerry did this with me, was at that time in 2014, called the Wickham Point Detention Centre, was still open, where a number of asylum seekers had been. So I went through DASAN, Darwin Asylum Seeker Support and Advocacy Network, contacted them, and they set up something so that Kerry and I could go into the Wickham Point Detention Centre every couple of weeks and spend some time speaking with a family whose experience was they'd been on Nauru, then they were sent here to Wickham Point, and they'd been in detention for close to 2 years. And so, a very distressing experience for them. That was a hands-on experience of doing some justice doing myself, and I appreciated David's challenge there. And yes, that just, it gave me a direct experience of, yes, I knew something about the refugee experience, but here was a direct experience. Here I was speaking to a family and hearing what it was like for them to be in detention in this limbo world for such a long time where they didn't know what was going to happen.
And I know that Indigenous issues are also something that's very close to your heart.
Yes.
Can you speak to your history of justice doing in that area?
Again, I've had an interest in this for, it goes back a long time in my life, back to experiences at school where, I was at school in the late 1960s, so yeah, a fair while ago, where I suppose some of the work that was being done at the time, you could look back at it now and think it was perhaps a bit paternalistic, but that was more the way the thinking was at the time. There was an opportunity for me as a young person to get involved on a Saturday morning with teaching some young Aboriginal children to read. So, making that contribution to helping them to be better educated, giving them hopefully a better opportunity in our Western world. And it was a little bit of an introduction to me to some of those broader issues of, okay, how come so many Aboriginal people are in this situation here in our country. So that's where it came from. And then through my years in the Christian Brothers, it built up a bit more. There was a fair bit of a partnership, and I mainly worked in Brisbane when I was in the Christian Brothers, a fair bit of a partnership between the management team of the Brothers and some of the Aboriginal organisations in Brisbane. So that gave me another wider experience of getting to understand some more of those wider issues, you know, the impacts of colonialism and intergenerational trauma, some of those sort of things that I was starting to get a little bit more of an understanding of. And then coming to Relationships Australia, I was able to get a bit more of that understanding. And one of the significant things has been cultural awareness and cultural fitness that came from Relationships Australia nationally through the Relationships Australia Indigenous Network, and just the document they put out probably about 10 years ago that was really inviting all of the non-Aboriginal staff in Relationships Australia across the country to reflect on white privilege. That was the first opportunity I'd had to do some reading and thinking in that area. So a number of things through my life have built one upon the other. The important starting point is I need to reflect on myself, my own understanding of Western culture, and my own understanding of white privilege. That's where it has to start from.
So what has that process been like for you, reflecting on your own white privilege, and how has that played out in, I guess, supervision and maybe your wider work as well?
So I might start with supervision. So having done some thinking myself about white privilege, and I'm referring here particularly to the supervisee who was living and working in the Aboriginal community. She was relatively new to the organisation, so she just had a bit of an opportunity to do some of that reading around white privilege. So I was able to talk to her about, well, what was it like for you to, when you did that reading, what was it like for you to do some reflection on that white privilege? Was it something of a challenge for you? What was it like? How are you thinking that might help you in your own work now as you're working in an Aboriginal community? So that was the way that I tried to use it. And I know it was a challenging experience for the supervisee that I was working with, particularly in her first few months of living and working in that community. And she did comment to me afterwards, and I had the opportunity to work with her as a supervisee for, I think, 2 years, all told. She was able to say that she appreciated that and what I tried to do was gently encourage her to think about these things. It wasn't about, well, the purpose of my supervision now is to somehow invite you to feel guilty about this, or invite you to feel guilty about white privilege, because I think that can be quite paralysing to if someone's invited to think in that way. So to think more about, well, yes, this is a reality. How can we use it in a way that's not guilt-inducing, that's not paralysing in some way, but that opens up some opportunities?
Your paper also alluded to some other insights, I guess, when you brought in a focus on justice doing. I'm wondering, how did that translate to the practitioner going out and thinking in a justice doing kind of way? Because in the supervision room, you're having a discussion about it. Did it have any knock-on effects to what actually happened on the ground and the way the practitioner thought about their work? Or did it change anything for them?
I think there were contributions that the supervision conversations were able to make. So for the person working on the Aboriginal community, it was inviting her to look at the practice that she was doing and to see, well, how can a justice lens be translated to some day-to-day work. So in particular, for that practitioner, it was about how can she listen as carefully as possible to some of the Aboriginal co-workers and also the Aboriginal families that she was working with. How can she listen carefully and learn and see herself as, yes, she's making a contribution herself in some way, but she's also very much a learner from her co-workers and from the families that she's working with. So that was the way that I invited her to put the justice doing into practice in that context. And then with the supervisee who was working in Catherine, there was an opportunity for me as the supervisor to be a little bit more directly involved in that there were particular conversations I was having with the supervisee about a family she was working with, including obviously mainly the young person who was at a school in Catherine, who I think was about 10 years old, and some of the struggles he was having with what he perceived as some unfair treatment from the school. And obviously that was impacting on him, and it was impacting on his family. So I was encouraging the practitioner to be working with him, supporting him and exploring, well, what were some of the things that he and the family were doing to recognise and address some of this injustice. And then a more direct contribution I was able to make was out of the conversations I was having with the supervisee to write a therapeutic letter, which was something that I'd picked up from the conversation, which I invited the practitioner to take back and show to the boy and to his family to try and highlight for him and his family, well, these are some of the things that I'm hearing you doing that are, you know, standing up to this injustice in some way. You're not just letting it happen and thinking, well, there's nothing I can do about this. Because he was. He and his family were taking some steps to address that injustice with the school. So I wanted to invite the practitioner to support that, and then I wanted to support the practitioner in doing that as well.
Yeah, that's a really great example. Thanks for sharing that story. As a supervisor, you've talked about some of the challenges that supervisees have faced in their experience of working in Aboriginal communities or with Aboriginal clients. But as a supervisor yourself, what have been some of the challenges for you in doing that supervision work?
Certainly, when it comes to the supervision I was doing with the practitioner working on the Aboriginal community, one of the challenges I faced was to hold back from, because I'd done, you know, some more reading than the practitioner had had the opportunity to do, not to position myself that, now I know, somehow I know more about this than you do, because she was the one immersed in the direct experience. I wasn't. You know, I had had some direct experience quite a number of years ago in working in a different couple of Aboriginal communities in Northeast Arnhem Land. I had no direct experience working in the particular community that this practitioner was working in. So that was one of the challenges, not to, I don't know, putting myself in an expert position quite captures it, but I think there's always a bit of a temptation in that, because there's always a power difference in supervision, to be invited into, as the supervisor, somewhat of an expert type position. And all my understanding of narrative ways of working is it's about stepping back from, yes, bringing some expertise in the process, not stepping back from that, but stepping back from, well, I'm an expert here in how you should be working with the families and the co-workers out there on the community.
So by not positioning yourself as an expert and having less direct experience than perhaps the supervisees had had, can you think about what skills, knowledge, beliefs or values you brought that were most helpful in dealing with that challenge for you?
Again, I think it goes back to my experience and understandings of narrative ways of working, so that I was able, fairly well I think, not to see that as, oh, now I'm at a disadvantage because I don't know, I haven't got this experience. Yes, I have to recognise that I haven't got that experience, but what I can then bring from the narrative ways of working is looking at it a bit, if you like, from outside, and being able to then perhaps better ask questions to invite the practitioner to reflect on what was happening for her, what does this mean for her, how is she reacting to this, how is she responding to this. So I think that's one of the things that my understandings of narrative ways of working have brought to an approach I would have to supervision.
Are there any particular principles within the narrative way of working that really you're holding while you're having those conversations?
I think the main one that I hold, particularly in supervision, is a real interest in what are the values and principles that this practitioner I'm working with, what are the values and principles that he or she is trying to work from as they work with their clients. So to me, again, that's one of the key aspects of the narrative worldview, is part of everyone's story is, yes, there can be problems around, but problems aren't the whole story. Everyone has values, principles, intentions that they are trying to work from, not always consciously, but to be invited to step back and name those values and principles and commitments and intentions has a value in itself. And then inviting, well, having named those, what does that mean? How might you, you know, be better or differently putting those in practice when you, you know, when you're working with clients?
What is it about narrative practice that you really connect with and you've taken as a framework, if you like, in your supervision work and in your counselling as well? Because we do know that it's one of the most effective ways of working with Aboriginal people. And it's now recognised by the AASW yes. to be such. And I'm wondering, what is it about that way of working that you see as most valuable in your supervision work with people who are working with Aboriginal clients?
That this, and I see a great overlap between the narrative worldview and a social work worldview, which is that whatever story someone is bringing to, you know, any therapy interaction or any other sort of interaction at all, whatever story, it's not just an individual story. Everyone is in, you know, much broader context, a family context, a cultural context, a social context. So it's understanding that those contexts are always there and they're shaping of an individual story and an individual's life, and sometimes shaping it in perhaps ways that are restricting, but other times, especially in the narrative approach, looking for, well, how can some of those connections that are there in a person's life, how can they be more shaping of positive ways of living my life, of positive ways of thinking about myself as a person? So that's one of the things that I have really appreciated about narrative, and as I said, a bit of an overlap with what I understand as a social work worldview as well.
At what point in your life did you come across narrative ideas, and why do you think that it really appealed to you at that time?
I first came across narrative ideas in 98, 99 and 2000. I'd made a decision prior to 1998 to move away from teaching. I particularly wanted to move into the counselling area, so I chose to study a Bachelor of Social Work, which started here at, well, NTU it was then known, and then I was able to do some external study through Charles Sturt Uni in Wagga, so that I could finish in 3 years instead of 4 years, which was a big advantage. And that's where my first contact with narrative ideas came. And then in the very first placement I had at Resolve here in Darwin with Tony Vito, he was the manager of Resolve in those days. He was my supervisor. They had a little library of tapes of what were called master therapists working. And one of them was a tape of Michael White working. And so that was another direct contact I had with narrative ideas, just that way of working, that really respectful way of engaging with clients, and, you know, not positioning as an expert and really looking to, you know, externalize problems and look for an alternative story. Not that I had all those understandings the very first time that I learnt about narrative. But yeah, there was something there in that approach that fitted for me, that fitted with my worldview, if you like, that, as I said before, had been shaped so much by my schooling experience and by my time in the Christian Brothers as well.
I'm interested in finding out if there's any particular people that have influenced you. So you've mentioned just now Michael White.
Yes.
And earlier you talked about Vicki Reynolds. And I'm wondering, yeah, is there any other mentors, or these might be people in your family even, that have really shaped, I guess, the practitioner that you are and the way you're doing supervision today?
What comes to mind immediately, and this is going back a long time in my life, this is going back to my time at school, one of the, I'll get a bit emotional here, one of the brothers that was at the school that I went to, he didn't actually teach me directly, but he ran a group that was very much interested in social justice type issues. And anyone in the school could be a part of that group. That experience there, and that's when I mentioned before that I had an opportunity to be involved on a Saturday morning teaching some young Aboriginal children to read, or helping them with their reading skills. That was an opportunity that came through this brother. His name is Gordon Sheriff. He died a number of years ago now. He had been at that particular school where I went to school for, I'm not sure how many years, but he was there. I started at the school in 1964. He was there well before I came there. He was there well after I finished as well. So he was so much a part of that school and the experience that was there. So that was a really strong influence.
Can you speak particularly about the things that you learnt from him, or what was it that he taught you that you've really held precious?
It was like just a very gentle approach. And this was in the days, in the 1960s, at a boys-only Catholic school, where corporal punishment was very much around. And as far as I know, he would never have used that. He didn't teach me directly. So he brought a very gentle approach, very much concerned with, well, if you're going to be a Christian, then justice is there as part of it. He mightn't have put it in those words, but that was his belief, that as a Christian, this is what you do. This is what, if you like, this is what Jesus teaches. This is what's in the Gospels, and this is how you put it into practice.
So this gentleness that you're describing, how has this played out in your life, and how have you carried forward what Brother Gordon has taught you indirectly?
Yeah. It's something I haven't necessarily thought about a lot before, but I think that gentle type approach, as I think back on it now, because I think I've carried that with me through my life, it's become somewhat embedded, I suppose. And when I'm working with clients, when I'm working with supervisees, yeah, I try to bring that. I don't know that I do it consciously. I think, as I said, I think it's embedded, and I would see that I try to use a gentle approach. I might not have ever described it in that way before. And that's one of the things when you're invited to step back, do some reflection, think about, well, where some things come from. Yeah, some realizations can come that perhaps hadn't put into words before.
I'm just wondering if Brother Gordon wasn't part of your life, whether things might have been shaped differently for you or not.
Probably yes.
In what ways?
He was very influential in my decision as a young 15-year-old to say, well, I want to be a part of this Christian Brothers Order, which I was for 20-plus years. So had that influence not been there, there would have been a big chapter in my life that would have been very different, that I wouldn't have had that opportunity to build on some of those understandings of justice, some of those understandings of, well, what's the position of Aboriginal people in Australia, and why are so many Aboriginal people and so many communities in a disadvantaged situation? So I wouldn't have had that opportunity. Or if I did, it would have been in a very different way.
If Brother Gordon was here with us in this room right now, what story do you think he would tell me about the way that you've carried on this gentle approach and these understandings of justice that he shared with you, I guess, early in your life?
Yeah.
What do you think he would say?
I think he might talk about some of the things that, at his encouragement, that I was doing when I was at school, like teaching young Aboriginal children to read, visiting young people in hospital. That was another part of what we were invited to do. So I think he would talk about that. And then in my life in the Brothers, for all of that 20 years that I was in the Brothers, he was still alive. I didn't have the opportunity to work directly with him anymore. but I think he would know, because he had great contacts in a number of Aboriginal communities in Queensland, and a lot of Aboriginal people had a lot of respect for him. When I had the opportunity to be the principal of a school in Brisbane, one of the things I tried to do was make some links with some of the local Aboriginal elders and try and have the school open to more Aboriginal students coming. And I think he would comment on that. Here I was putting into practice some of what he encouraged me to do and to learn about when I was at school.
And would he be surprised at the way you're bringing justice to your work now in the supervision room and in other aspects of your life?
I don't think he'd be surprised. I think he would be heartened at the fact that I was doing more reflecting about working with Aboriginal people. You know, he may not have done much thinking or reading himself around the idea of white privilege, but I think he, in his own life, he lived out in some way that an understanding that white people in Australia are in a privileged position, and you know, we need to reflect on what that means and make a contribution to doing something about that.
So, thinking about the future, what ways will you be holding on to these little discoveries we've made today about justice doing and gentleness and valuing story and understanding narrative ways of working and being in the world?
So certainly when it comes to justice doing and supervision, just to that particular topic, I have much more limited opportunities to be involved in supervision now. But one of the things that I noticed, this year I've been supervising two practitioners in Alice Springs, so doing it either over the phone or via Zoom. And I've noticed that some of the focus on justice doing had, and trying to tie it in with the supervision, had slipped away somewhat. So just recently, I've written myself a little reminder that as I look at my supervision file for each of the supervisees, to think, well, how can I invite some of that reflection on justice doing? Or how can I listen for, perhaps the way that this person's working, perhaps that's an indication of some of the values they hold around justice, and how can I ask more questions about that and invite them to reflect on it? So that's something that I've only just started doing, perhaps in the last month or so. It's sobering to think things can slip away, but that's what happens sometimes. Things do slip away for one reason or another. So it's really good to have something like this that reminds me about that justice doing, and to be reminded about it myself in my own supervision that I'm doing. That's where the reminder came from. And then the gentleness that's come out of our conversation today, I'd like to bring that more consciously to not only to the supervision I do, but I suppose to all of the work I do and to my life as well, to be more conscious of, well, this is an important part of my approach to life. It's been there with me all the time, and it's been great to bring it to some more consciousness and hopefully it'll help me to carry that into the future, so I can think how can I use that more in my work and in my life.
Finishing up, because we're probably almost running out of time, are there any particular resources you'd like to share with other supervisors or supervisees working with Aboriginal clients or communities?
Certainly I would encourage the Vicky Reynolds readings, even though she writes from a Canadian context, but she writes a lot about First Nations people in Canada as well, which can certainly, I think, be carried over to an Australian context. I'm more than happy to share the full copy of the project that I did, which has quite an extensive list of readings at the end of it,
right,
including a number from, I can't remember how many, but probably four or five that I read from Vicky Reynolds, and she's a fairly prolific writer. She's written more articles than that, but they would be a good place to start, I think, for people who are interested in that.
Awesome. And is there a way that people can follow up with you if they'd like to touch base, either online or in person? How might they do that?
I'm happy to provide both my work and my home email addresses. if they're interested in some face-to-face contact, well, that's a good way to ask about it, and then we can
follow
it up from there.
Awesome. I'd just like to thank you for taking your Sunday afternoon to speak with me today. And as someone who's been on the receiving end of your supervision, I can certainly attest to the gentleness and the wisdom that comes through understanding from a narrative perspective ourselves and the work that we're doing. So I just want to thank you very much, because I know that you supervised me for about 3 years.
Yes.
While I was working out on the Tiwi Islands, and it was such an awesome experience, and yeah, one that really enriched my development and the way my practice framework developed. So
okay.
I just want to thank you for that.
Thank you, Lucy. I appreciate your comments, and thank you. Thank you for this interview and for the interesting things that it brings up when you invite reflection, particularly into earlier influences on how I am in life now and what I bring to things. So that was very useful. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. Music by Flashback Digital. You can access all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphorically-speaking.com.au. I'm currently on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. If you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphorically-speaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.